Hello. Welcome to Taking Liberties, the podcast of Harvard's Civil Rights, Civil Liberties Law Review. I'm your host, Maisie Teitler, and today I'm speaking with Professor Alexander Chen, who is the founding director of Harvard's newest clinic, the LGBTQ+ Advocacy Clinic. Professor Chen graduated from Harvard Law School in 2015, then clerked in the United States District Court for the Southern District of California and the Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. He spent 2 years working on national LGBTQ civil rights impact litigation, as well as policy advising, education, and outreach. Professor Chen, CRCL is so excited to have this new clinic on campus, and we want to give listeners sort of an inside look into your journey to this work and also how the first semester is going. So to start off, can you give us a little bit of an idea of how you came to the work that you do now?
Absolutely. And first of all, thank you so much to CRCL for inviting me to be on the podcast. I was on the general board of CRCL my first year of law school and remember it fondly. So I'm really excited to be speaking to some of the CRCL's podcast listeners today. In terms of my journey to this work, I was just telling Izzy on the way up here that I actually never expected to be in law school. I never expected to be an attorney because I really only came to this work to do the work that I'm doing now, right? To advocate on behalf of the LGBT community and more specifically the trans community. What happened with me is that after I graduated from college, I went through a really dramatic and tumultuous 3 years where I moved continents in order to be able to pursue my gender transition. I was born in the States, but then I was living abroad in Asia. I was educated in the UK and living in Asia again when I was trying to achieve my gender transition, and I had to move to New York City, sight unseen, without knowing anybody there, in order to access free legal and medical services that they had for people who didn't have health insurance and didn't have resources in the city. And so I think that experience is what really inspired me to go to law school, because I was so, like, it was so transformative to my life that I had access to those services. Like, I have no idea what would have happened to me if I hadn't been able to do that. And at the same time, those services were so under-resourced and underfunded, and the people who I was meeting who were like fantastic, lovely members of the community were experiencing so many problems, right? There were people who were unhoused, there were people who were engaged in survival sex work, there were people who were forced to stay in abusive relationships with family or with loved ones because there was no other place that they could live. And I was so frustrated by all of that suffering that I was seeing around me. And so that was really what inspired me to go to law school in the first place. And, you know, at the time that I decided to do it, which was thinking back at like 2010, 2011, like a decade ago, it really seemed like a super, super niche thing to do, right? It was kind of like at a time when, you know, marriage equality wasn't the law of the land. There was still a lot of fighting going on, a lot of backlash about same-sex marriage. And also, you know, transgender people and their issues, although there were some really amazing organizations already starting to be formed who were doing great work, weren't on the national radar the way they are now. And there were only a handful of advocates around the country who were really doing this work, but the work that they were doing was life-saving. So I thought, you know, I'm going to go and just try to do this, but I thought it was a really very esoteric thing to do. Mm. And I was really completely against my expectation that it was really going to take over the national conversation in this way, in a way that's in some ways very painful, especially for transgender people, but at the same time super critical to getting rights and protection going forward.
Thank you so much for sharing that element of your journey with our listeners. Can you describe, I guess, sort of, you said you weren't interested in law school and then had this experience. Can you talk about after, once you had finished law school, I guess, was it just like a straight shot into doing the work that you do now and doing this advocacy, or sort of what did the first years look like in between graduation and school and now being the founding director of this clinic?
Sure. And I'll maybe just take one step back to even when I was a law student, because mm-hmm. I think, although I will say this, since, you know, it wasn't that long ago that I was a 1L, even though I came in with that goal, I quickly found myself doubting whether it was something that I was really going to be able to do. Mm-hmm. I think I had the experience that a lot of 1Ls did of like, gosh, I had this idea for what I wanted to do. Seems really challenging career-wise to achieve that. Should I maybe go work at a firm? Should I kind of do the same things as everybody else? And, you know, it was really my experience volunteering and working at different LGBT organizations that made me think, you know, I'm so inspired by the work that they're doing here that it's okay for me to try and go for this, right? And that I actually, you know, like, this is what I came to law school to do, mm-hmm. and it's worth a shot. And so I summered while I was a student at the ACLU LGBT Rights Project at the National Center for Transgender Equality, which is a leading federal policy think tank on trans issues, and at the Department of Justice in the Civil Rights Division during the Obama administration. And so those experiences kind of convinced me that, like, it was worth trying to pursue a career in this. So that was kind of always my goal coming out of law school. I clerked for 2 years because I knew that I wanted to start out by doing litigation, and it just turned out it was a really fabulous experience for that. And then after that, you know, I pursued a fellowship funding to start working at my organization, the National Center for Lesbian Rights. So I got a 2-year fellowship through Baker McKenzie and Salesforce.org and the Equal Justice Works Foundation to fund me to start my work there. And so I was really, really lucky to get that funding. And it's so important because nonprofit organizations are so underfunded. It's so difficult to get that type of experience. And so I was just incredibly lucky to be able to get that. And I feel really grateful to have that opportunity. And I know a lot of other people really hope to have as well. And so, when I was at NCLR, I was able to do a really amazing mix of all kinds of different LGBT advocacy work. I was on the litigation team for 2 of the transgender military ban cases challenging the Trump administration rescinding the open service policy of the Obama administration. I also was on the litigation team for a landmark Ninth Circuit case called Edmo v. Corizon, which is a case involving a Native American transgender woman in Idaho who, although she had actually tried to castrate herself twice, was denied access to gender confirmation surgery in prison, and the Ninth Circuit became the first court of appeal to rule that it's unconstitutional under the Eighth Amendment. It's cruel and unusual punishment to withhold that medically necessary care. I also did a really important case in the Southern District of California called Prescott v. Rady Children's Hospital, which is a tragic case involving a trans kid in a local children's hospital who was really badly mistreated when he was held there and in a voluntary hold, and after he was released, committed suicide because of the way that the hospital refused to respect his gender identity. And so it was, and I also, sorry, I forgot about this. I also helped to co-draft a bill called AB 2119 that made California the first state in the country to put into place a statutory entitlement to gender-affirming care for kids who are in foster care. It's a huge problem where trans kids who are in foster care, the system, there's nobody who can make that medical authorization for them to get access to this life-saving care. And they, you know, there are a lot of people who are not well trained in the foster care system, and you have kids who are the most vulnerable who have no ability to access this. And so it was really just amazing opportunity to work on these issues in a cutting edge way and really help some of the most vulnerable members of our community.
Fantastic. So I guess moving on to your work now and your new role, can you give listeners some background on the clinic for folks who might not be at the law school or who haven't had the chance to learn more about it yet?
Absolutely. So the Harvard LGBTQ plus Advocacy Clinic is a new clinic that the law school launched this term in January of 2020. So what has happened is that I've been brought on board to be the founding director of that clinic and to kind of really establish this program and figure out, you know, what kind of clinical experiences the students are going to get. And so we've started out with a pilot of 4 students in this term. And the students have been working on a mix of projects that I would, broadly speaking, put into 3 categories. One is sort of direct legal services, one is impact litigation work, and one is policy advocacy work. So first, to start out with the direct legal services piece, we've partnered with an LGBT organization that has a legal helpline. And in that legal helpline, you know, they get callers and emailers who are contacting them, the members of the community who are saying, we just have a gamut of problems that they're experiencing. So, you know, they are understaffed and have a high volume. They have been sending some of those helplines to us, and the students are spending about a quarter of their time responding to those. And it's a nice way, I think, for the students to see the mix of issues that come in the door, like what people are experiencing, and then to figure out, well, is this a situation where we can provide some direct assistance, whether it is representation or it's, you know, targeted sort of like legal resources, or is it a situation where we can refer them to another organization and sort of kind of experience what it's like to have that kind of problem solving and to have that kind of community contact? Secondly, we have been doing some work to support the impact litigation work of national organizations. So, for example, on that case that I mentioned, the Edmo case with the transgender prisoner in Idaho, that case is one where the governor of Idaho now wants to seek certiorari review in the Supreme Court. And so my organization that I used to work at reached out to us and said, hey, we could really use some help. Can you and your students take a look at the Eighth Amendment jurisprudence of the 3 conservative justices that we think might be persuaded not to vote to grant cert? That's Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Kavanaugh, and Justice Gorsuch. And can you take a deep dive into their Eighth Amendment jurisprudence and figure out, like, are there arguments that would appeal to them for why they shouldn't grant cert, right? And so that's something that I put each of several of my students on, and they've been doing that dive. We are also working on a potential amicus brief in a Sixth Circuit case, which involves a professor who was fired by his university for persistently refusing to use the preferred pronouns, or the pronouns of the of a transgender student, and was fired by his university as a result. And then he is now suing his university, claiming that under the First Amendment he has a free speech right to engage in that conduct. Mm-hmm. And so we are exploring a possible amicus brief on First Amendment doctrine and why we can distinguish between that type of harassing, targeting behavior, singling out one student, and generally speaking, just making an academic statement about, right, you know, LGBT issues in a social matter.
Wonderful. And it sounds like you've managed to strike a good balance between doing the direct work that keeps you in touch with the community and these sort of bigger and high impact cases. And I think that's a nice experience for students to be able to have the chance to do both in a clinic, not always true of clinics here or elsewhere.
I think that, you know, there can often be a perception that there's a very big gulf between what people think of as impact litigation and what they think of as direct services, and certainly in perhaps some other areas of law, that division is perhaps stronger. I can't speak directly to that. But I think that in this area, especially when you're talking about cases that are more cutting edge, I think that distinction really collapses, right? Like, I think that when you get people coming through the door, you say, for example, I worked in the past with a military family that had a transgender daughter, and they were seeking to get her access to medical care within the military system, but they were stationed abroad. Now, we were looking at that as a potential impact matter, right? Where that could have been something that we challenged. You know, we could have challenged TRICARE, which is the health care that military families get. But in the end, actually, the thing that made the most sense for that family and that kid who urgently needed that care was for the parent to take a job stationed back in the state so that she could get access to local care, right? And right. So oftentimes, whether something turns into an impact case or not is highly dependent on a huge number of factors. And a lot of what people think of as like direct services or direct assistance is what you're doing when you're facilitating helping somebody. And if that doesn't work out, then you end up with something that is an impact case because there isn't precedent on this issue. And so at least when it comes to issues that are affecting trans folks, issues that are affecting the most marginalized folks within the LGBT community, LGBT people of color, a lot of the times there's not as much daylight between impact work and direct work as people think. And I think the other thing is that, you know, part of why I was interested in taking this job is that I think that when I was a student, I was always trying to understand what does it look like to even do social change work, right? Is it just this, like, you bring impact cases? How did they get here? How did they become what they are? You get these cases in the casebook and they just come like ice blocks out of the sky. It's like ice block. And you're like, well, how did they get here? And so I think in the course in the clinic, I'm trying to unpack that a little bit and say, okay, well, here are the range of things that meant that something turned out this way. Mm. Or if you have a problem, what is the best way to solve it, right? Sometimes the answer is litigation. Sometimes the answer is an angry letter. Sometimes the answer is, you know, political pressure. It's a media campaign. It's trying to get a private company to change policy. It's trying to pass a law. It's trying to pass a regulation. There are so many different ways to do this. And I think it's really important to be flexible about the tool that you use and not to think, okay, I have a hammer, so where are the nails, right?
Right, exactly. And I think that just sounds like a very welcome addition to the law school, because speaking as someone who has public interest ambitions myself, it is often very mystifying and kind of strange to come in and have this desire to help people and then just see the options are, you know, firm. As you mentioned earlier, the options are mostly firm, and then maybe a couple of professors who have a background in public interest who will talk to you. But to give people the experience to actually do that kind of work now and present it in a way that's accessible, I think is really exciting to have on the campus.
And I will add that although I personally didn't go to a firm, I think what I learned when I went out into the world of practice is that it's a much more complicated decision, both professionally, personally, career-wise, but also ethically and strategically about where you go than that. Because I think that, you know, it can be so much this kind of firm, not firm dynamic here that we get, it basically sounds like, oh, should I quote unquote sell out and go to a firm, or should I be pure of heart and join a nonprofit? But you know, there's been a lot of very cogent critiques of what people call the nonprofit industrial complex, the way that nonprofits are funded, the way that nonprofits pay their employees, the kind of working conditions that people labor under, sort of, you know, representation issues within the nonprofit industry. So it's not a sort of like, you know, safe haven which is immune from the capitalist pressures of the rest of our society and the philanthropic pressures of the rest of our society. And at the same time, firms are actually a really important part of much of the work that gets done. Pro bono work is a really important part of that. And a lot of people move between these worlds, right? And just because you go on one path when you start and not the other, it doesn't mean that's where you're going to be landing in the end. A lot of people who go into the nonprofit world burn out because of the working conditions and because of an idealism and a disillusionment that sets in. A lot of people who start out at firms end up in the nonprofit sector. So I think the other thing I wanted to kind of do when I came back here is kind of maybe complicate that conversation a little bit. I think people can sometimes feel here like they establish a certain identity or a certain track within like sort of nanoseconds of arriving on this campus in a way that's very, very odd. And they can feel like that is the track that they're quote unquote on. And I think the other thing that I was inspired by is kind of this notion of, look, like actually every single person who's at this law school has this amazing ability to go out and make change. And you can probably feel here like it's a very big school and you don't stand out. But the thing is that when you get out into the world, there are so many people out there who need creative, passionate, engaged people who want to help and change things, right? And I think having the desire to do that and going out there and trying to do it and trying to learn from people who are doing it and understanding that there's no perfect roadmap to it, it's just about getting that experience, is a message that I want to bring to the students.
Right. And I guess kind of spinning off of that and trying to put it all together, when you think about this clinic now or sort of in the wider world of law school or the wider world of the world, what do you view its goals as, or the role you want it to play in fitting the legal world together?
Mm-hmm. So I think that in terms of the goals of the clinic itself, I really heard from the students when I was listening to them when I was interviewing for this position, and it was really in line with my own view that it's really important to try and center folks who are underrepresented within the LGBTQ community, right? It's a very interesting community because it encompasses people of different racial groups, of different socioeconomic backgrounds, cultural backgrounds, which I think is both like the unique strength of the LGBTQ community and also a source of a lot of its pain. A lot of it is pain because we come often from, you know, like family backgrounds or cultural backgrounds that don't understand LGBT people, who are just not immersed in that themselves. But also because it means I think that there can be a lot of divisions within the LGBT community that, if you look into the history of it, are kind of like a perennial aspect of the conflicts within the community. Conflicts that I think don't necessarily, like, the emphasis on conflict doesn't necessarily center the fact that it's centering everybody in the community and making sure that we're paying equal weight to the needs of everybody in the community. That is what has made the LGBT movement strong in the past, and it's going to make it strong in the future, right? And it's really going to inspire people to understand that this movement still has relevance to younger people who are looking at things in a more intersectional framework. So for me, I think in terms of thinking about the projects that we're going to be working on, one goal of mine is to maintain that focus on issues that predominantly affect more underrepresented folks in the community. And the other, I think, goal is really over time to develop our own docket of cases. Mm-hmm. And I think there are several reasons for that. One is I think it's a good experience for the students to be able to see kind of like representation, sort of like, you know, like nuts to bolts, like from sort of like the beginning to the end. And I think also it will give the clinic an opportunity to sort of kind of like develop a sort of like caseload over time that can really mean that we're driving the bus in terms of where we want resources to go, right? I think it's one of those like you have to be the change that you believe in kinds of things, right? Yeah. I think for many, many different very complex political, ethical, structural, community-based and other reasons, it's really challenging. We're very under-resourced as a movement, the LGBT movement, and there's, you know, we're doing a lot of defensive fighting right now. There's a lot of, you know, ways in which we are the tipping point the tipping point of the spear on the culture wars. And so there are not as many resources as there could be in thinking about how can we move the needle forward going into the future, right? Mm-hmm. So I'd really like to see us develop a docket of cases that is pushing the envelope in that way and thinking about how we can kind of be a leader of like doing this work in that way and kind of advancing the rights of people who are less like sort of like within the sort of like they're still somewhat in the shadows of our society.
Right. And I guess building off of that, and I know you alluded to this just now a little bit with building a docket, but is that sort of what you see as the future for this clinic in the next 2 or 5 years or however far in the future? Is that, you know, developing strong cases that students can actually be part of the team lead on? Is that what you think?
Yeah, sure. I think that's definitely a part of what I'm hoping. And I think the other part of it is that I'm hoping that we'll be able to grow. You know, I have currently 4 students in the clinic, and next term I'll be taking 6 and 6 in each of the terms. So the way that's going to work is it's 3 to 5 credits, 6 students per term through Helios. And there will be a pre/co-requisite course in the fall that I'll teach called Gender Identity, Sexual Orientation, and the Law, which will take both clinical and non-clinical students. But I know that there is more demand than that here in the law school. there's a really large proportion of students that identify as LGBT these days, even more so than when I was a student. And I think there's a real pent-up demand for this type of opportunity. But at the same time, I want to make sure that the students have a high-quality experience where they really get to work with me, they get good supervision, and they're able to work on projects in a way where they feel like they are growing and learning. And I think that in order to provide that experience to more students, this clinic needs more resources and needs more staff. And so I'd like to see it grow.
And you've guessed my next question correctly, which is whether you could share your thoughts on queer representation within the teaching faculty here or the clinical faculty. So approximately 25% of HLS's incoming class of 2023 identify as members of the LGBTQ plus community, but we only have a handful of professors who actively engage with Lambda, and fewer professors who work on issues relating to our community. And so I guess, what do you think the school or the student body can be doing better than it currently is to help both build vertical relationships and create the space and resources necessary to have an enduring queer community here?
Great question. So I will say, this was a challenge when I was a student as well. You know, when I was here, I was on the board of Lambda. We were actually the year that petitioned, that sort of did the initial petition and study to have an LGBTQ advocacy clinic.
Wow.
Which was actually what we turned to after the administration did not respond as actively as we were hoping to our request for them to hire more permanent faculty to teach, you know, LGBT courses. And so this was, you know, 6-7 years ago. I had no idea that it would lead to me having this job in a funny kind of way.
And
I know
that your past self for the,
well,
for
it's
legwork.
Also the, but it's the sustained and consistent pressure from the students, right? And so first of all, I would say, like, it's a huge step that this clinic is even being founded. Mm-hmm. I think that that is due to the, like, persistence and the passion of the students. And I also think the administration hearing that and responding to it, which, you know, I think is something that they should be lauded for. But I think that, you know, there is perhaps somewhat of a generational gap in representation, in the number of people who identify as LGBTQ, in what people think of as quote-unquote legal work or legal scholarship, and how they frame what legal work is. And so I think that there has been, and there's a pipeline problem. I think it's a huge pipeline problem.
Right.
I'm actually also on the board of an organization that I helped start, the National Trans Bar Association. And, you know, in the last 5 years, there's been an explosion in the number of members that we have, the number of people who are going to law school. And so it's not, I mean, of course, it's not just a pipeline problem, but I think pipeline has been a big part of it in the past. I think that especially LGBT folks who are gender conforming or who are minorities in other ways have historically found the law to be a very conservative profession, a very elitist profession, a challenging profession that enforces gender norms in a way that can feel very restrictive. And so I think that there has been a lot of difficulty in sort of just getting enough people to want to do this work. And then I think beyond that, there are challenges in having more recognition that it's not just like something that can be tokenized, that it's not just this niche thing, that academic work or scholarship on LGBT issues is something that shouldn't just be relegated to, you know, gender journals, but something which is worthy of wider consideration. And so I think that there has also been perhaps a ghettoization of LGBT scholarship in a way that makes it difficult, once you're siloed off, to necessarily amass the kind of credentials that you need in order to keep moving through this academic market, right? So I think there are a bunch of different reasons for it. I think that also that has led to a view that perhaps you only need X number of scholars who do this work, and you've satisfied a certain niche, even if those scholars are no longer researching or teaching in this field, or are not no longer teaching the courses that students are interested in, right? So I think there are a lot of different challenges, but to the extent that we can do something about them, I think that the movement comes from below, it comes from students, it comes from students saying, this is something that we are really interested in, we want more of this type of content. I think that's what happened with this clinic, and I think that expanding upon that and having more representation, having more resources, having more curricular offerings, having more curricular opportunities will also depend on all of us working together to help people in the administration and people who are making decisions about what legal education looks like understand that that's a really important part of legal education for many students.
Wonderful. And I guess, again, building off that, the last question I have for you is whether you have advice or tips for HLS students, perhaps an HLS student speaking to you, who are interested in joining the clinic or looking to do work similar to yours.
Sure. So first of all, I'm always happy to talk to any students, regardless of whether they're in my class or my clinic, about, you know, any career interest that they have. you can find me on the faculty page. I'm at achen@law.harvard.edu. Feel free to come talk to me during office hours or outside of office hours. I'm always happy to give back. I really benefited from mentors along the way who were able to give me information about how I ought to be thinking about my career development. I'm always happy to share. I also think that in terms of joining the clinic, I would encourage you to consider taking the course, Gender Identity, Sexual Orientation, and the Law. If you take it at any point as a 2L, then you can also take the clinic as a 3L without taking the course again, mm-hmm. since the content would be duplicative. And so if you're thinking maybe you want to do the clinic down the road, consider taking the course. There are more slots in it than are just reserved for the clinical students. Also, you have to take it in the fall if you want to take the clinic in the spring, because I'm offering it once a year. So just FYI on that one. I am not requiring an application because I wanted to keep this opportunity open to some students who haven't maybe dedicated their whole past career to it, but are really interested in doing this work. So it's just something where you're going to have to rank it on Helios. And there are 6 slots, so you know you can infer where you need to rank it in order to get into the clinic. I'm also happy to chat with students who might be interested in doing research work or other work as well. I'll probably be looking for some research assistance down the line for some policy and academic work that I'm hoping to do in addition to the clinical work. So I think there will be lots of different ways to get involved going forward.
Wonderful. I can't wait to interview you about all the work that happens in the next 2 years. But until then, thank you so much for agreeing to come on the show and telling everyone about the new clinic.
Thank you so much for having me.